This is the fourth hour in a series of change, watching the changing face of the moral problem of war. But there is a change not only in subject matter, but in style today. The past three sessions, we have been reviewing first the long scope of Western history, Christian thought about war and peace, and then the last time, recent developments, to see how there is, in a large section of the Christian and also secular culture of our time, more criticism directed to the institution of war than has been the case before, had been the case before, right on the level of evaluating whether war is morally acceptable. For this time, I propose something a little more complex, not more academic or abstruse, because it's a very commonsensical kind of question, but I do propose to pay attention to how we think, rather than just reporting on how people are thinking. I'm also still reporting on a change in that I'll be mentioning some develops in the field of ethics, that is, the field of technical, sometimes academic, analysis of ways of thinking. So in that sense, I'm also reporting on change in consciousness and mentalities. But in order to do that, I have to step back to something that all of us have in the back of our heads, but to try to lift it to consciousness so that we can be self-critical about it. It is, I think, it's very fair to report, very widely the case that people think there are two ways to think about morality. The two labels that were posted for this hour are among the ways that you can pair that off. That is, you may have an ethic of principle, or you may have an ethic of prudence. What's the difference? How do you hear those terms? What's, if you see people differing about how to reason, some people say it's a matter of principle. That means that there is something firm, there's something prescribed. Or if it's only a matter of prudence, then you kind of use your head to figure out the best you can what's more likely to work better. This generally means that the prudent people are the ones that talk about ends or consequences and these people talk about means. The ends don't justify the means. That's an ordinary slogan in ordinary lay language in these matters. It's not a highly philosophical question. Well, if you are going to do this kind of reasoning, you will usually base it on the facts of the situation. You just look out there and you see what is at stake. If we do this, this will follow. If we do that, that will follow. Obviously, this result is better than that result. You look at the facts of the situation and you use your ordinary reason in evaluating better and worse outcomes, consequences, where on the other side, the guidance tends, if you're going to know about a principle that is firmly binding and some means you must never use even to a good end, then probably you'll have to have some kind of revelation as a source here. This kind of reasoning usually can be opened up to anybody. You can show your neighbors, you can read another century's time, you can explain the factors of a decision. So this tends to be general, whereas it's possible on this side that since you get your principles from an authority, that they are particular. That is, Jews know about what to do about the Sabbath. Other people don't have that same information, are those same requirements. The same is the case for many kinds of ritual notions, which spill over into ethics. For instance, in the celebration of the Muslim fast. Here we assume that the human mind is autonomous. You have to do your own thinking. Maybe not only alone as an individual, but you use human resources that are generally available to look at the situation and decide which are the best consequences. On the other hand, if the guides come from somewhere else, it can be called heteronomous. That's the simple... Autonomous is a word we all know in ordinary English. The counterpart, or the opposite, is to be ruled by another. This is to be ruled by the self. This is to be ruled by something else. That is, God says, don't ever shed blood. God says to the Jews, don't ever eat pork. And the nature of that requirement isn't based on people making their own decisions. It comes down from above. These kinds of requirements tend, in most cultural experience, to be rigid, and these tend to be flexible. Now, does that pair of columns reflect anything you've heard about or thought about before, or ways you've tended to think or seen people think? It's not supposed to be original. It's supposed to be descriptive of ordinary patterns that we bring with us, whether from common sense or from more abstract philosophical analysis. And now, my assignment is to bring that split or that polarity into the conversation about reasons people have for and against regular killing in war. But before that, we ought to ask in a more general sense what decent people, moral people, religious people have in the past done about that set of choices. I think in a very broad sense, it's a very obvious report that in traditional settings of any religious community, moral guidance tends to be in the right column. That you know certain principles, you have them from the binding religious tradition, and we state them traditionally in proverbs like, the end does not justify the means, two wrongs don't make a right, never do evil that good may come. Those are all slogans that state the preference for the right column, and they are very much at home in traditional religious ethical settings. In a pluralistic society where people are quite aware that many different kinds of people have many different traditions, and that we somehow have to make sense to each other outside of those or beyond the limits of those traditions, and where we're also quite conscious of cultural change, and everybody has sometime outgrown the provincialism of some smaller world in which they grew up, we tend to prefer the left column. And that's the way our society has been running for the past two centuries in general, leaning in the direction of saying that's the way to do moral reasoning. Preference for each of the phrases that we have on the left side, except that it is a little disquieting that some of the firm things that we knew before, when the right was the way to think, are now being challenged. But in general, that's the tilt of our culture, is to prefer to think on the left more than on the right. The tendency, the odds would be that if we took time now to do some kind of a poll, you would be quite sure which side you stand on as to how to make moral decisions. Are there firm principles that basically don't change? Or do you look at the facts of the case and do the best you can? My hunch would next be, if we had more time to look at the results of our poll, that those of you who thought you were on the right, because you have pretty well gone through life thinking it does make sense to talk about firm principles, would, if pushed, have to recognize more than you thought that you would be willing to make exceptions, and that some of the principles are defined in ways that don't quite speak to all of life's problems after all, so you would find yourself taking some account of the left column. Probably more in need of argumentation is the counterpart to that. People who think they are on the left, who believe that they are flexible and situational, actually do also have still some firm commitments on the right that they often don't explain and analyze. And we'll see more clearly what this means if we bring it back to the question of war and peace rather than keeping it just abstract as I've done so far. The ordinary wisdom, especially clear in the last two centuries, beginning with Tolstoy, who was the most famous person in the 19th century reading the teachings of Jesus, and continuing with considerable clarity in our part of the world, up through the moral leadership of Reinhold and H. Richard Niebuhr, to theologians who dominated the middle of the century in American Protestantism. Those people would all have put Jesus on the right and the case for war on the left. Jesus is the representative of the principle, which is principles go, is perfectly clear in the gospel message, that not only is life sacred, but enemy life is sacred. And the case that has to be made for the civil order in general, and then for extreme cases where the civil order has to be defended by war, or has to be changed by necessary revolution, they are the adjustments that have to be made on generally practical grounds in particular situations where you can't see anything else to do. That's the standard account. And once this question is set up that way, obviously there will be times when you have to be on the left and have to choose that some violence is going to be necessary. Now, that's the standard way that anybody from the Cracker Barrel philosopher who just has deep common sense to the academic moral philosopher puts the question. It's not peculiar in academic way of reasoning. Now, my challenge is to see whether it's as obvious as it looked that that reasoning that I just laid out is convincing. And I'll start with the least profound end of the question, that is, I'll start with the limitations of this analysis that are the least important and try to end with the ones that are the most weighty. First of all, the best case where you can say, Jesus says, love your enemy, but I'm in this situation where I can't afford to, because look at what is at stake. The most evident cases that seem to be convincing of that in the commonsensical way that left column calls for are the ones that are least like war. They are, for instance, the individual settings of your home being broken into by a criminal maniac, or a crazed person in the tower of the university building shooting at people on the campus, where the oddness, the unusualness of the situation makes it quite evident to everybody who looks that there isn't anything else to do but something lethal. That's the least like war. Most wars don't even meet the criteria of being a matter of last resort, of being carried on for a good cause, of being carried on with limited use of unavoidable weapons. Those are the things we talked about the last 3 days. The causal system that makes war work doesn't hang together. That is, if I say somebody is breaking into my house and threatening my family, I have to stop him, if necessary, by killing him. The causal connections are all there. It's a self-evident case. Even then, there is argument about whether it has to be that way, whether there's some other way to stop him. But at least this evil thing that is likely to happen is a causal chain of consequences that anybody can reconstruct and say what it is that makes you think that in that situation you have to disobey Jesus and kill your enemy. But in war, it isn't that clear at all. War is not a clear causal mechanism with just one cause and one set of effects. There are all kinds of different parties trying to mix up the game at the same time. People don't know what's going to happen. People don't know how the weapons are going to work. People don't know how what the weather will be on a particular battlefield. You can't guarantee the consequences, the good consequences that will come from the exceptional reasoning that you give yourself to use lethal violence, the way one could practically guarantee at least that if I would kill the intruder, he wouldn't harm my family. One party in a war setting is not strong enough to determine the consequences, as the one party would be in the simple cases that are used to try to prove that logic. In war, the occasion is not an immediate drama of a bad guy, it's an institution. It's something that you prepare for years. You prepare for it on both sides for years. You prepare specialists to do nothing but that as a career. You prepare instruments as weapons, weapon systems that can't be used except for that purpose. So the model of a situation where all of a sudden you see there's nothing else to do but to infringe on some basic religious principle doesn't fit the institution of war. That's one set of questions. The next set of questions are more formally philosophical, and I'll just tick them off without arguing, that if you want to argue on the basis of consequences that I must infringe upon a certain principle, you still have to explain why the consequences that you think are better are better. You can't explain better consequences in terms of better consequences. That is, if you say, I have to kill my political enemy for the sake of the freedom of my nation, then you have to explain why is the freedom of my nation an absolute. If it's an absolute, then you're over on the right side after all, by saying that national pride or national sovereignty is a principle, and then you're not being practical after all. You're in the right column after all. So you can't really, philosophically or in Cracker Barrel philosophy, an ordinary lay argument, prove that an argument based only on consequences will ever work. Every argument based on consequences has to evaluate what you consider as good consequences, why it's your business to impose good consequences on the other guy, that is what authority you have to be the policeman of the world, rather than someone else having that authority to be policeman. So the philosophical case for reasoning based on consequences is weaker when it gets looked at closer, whether the philosophy be amateur or academic. But now I move to things that matter more as we get closer to our subject matter. One is that in the past two generations, many people thinking about moral thought have said that these two options are not, they don't cover the field. They're not inclusive. Instead of asking, in this particular setting, am I going to act on the basis of calculating consequences or on the basis of an absolute principle? You're missing some other things. You're missing what kind of a person you want to be. And more in the past generation, ethical thought has talked about virtue or about character. And to ask who I think I am or who we think we are as disciples of Jesus isn't either of those questions. It's something else. It will have spin-off in the realm of things that can be stated like principles, and it will have spin-off in the realm of things that can be stated like consequences, but it's more than either of those. One of the ways in which the inadequacy of this pattern is talked about is by labeling it decisionism or quandaryism, as if the best way to talk about moral values was always to assume that you have a hard moral choice. And if you have a hard moral choice, and you'll either go to war or be the victim of injustice. Or you'll either shoot the burglar or have him destroy someone in your family. If you keep focusing on very difficult crunch cases, you hide from view the fact that most of us don't meet cases like that most of the time in most of our lives. They're very rare cases. They have to be constructed. That doesn't mean they never happen. There are wartime settings where people do really have to decide whether to go off to war. There are urban violence questions where settings where people really do have to decide whether they're going to carry a knife or a pistol when they go out in the street. But they're not representative of most people most of the time that you're always making crunch decisions. In fact, depending on the kind of person you would like to be, very often when you get to the crunch, you feel the decision has been made already, because the kind of person you are isn't prepared to entertain some of the possibilities otherwise might have come up, either for good or for ill. So instead of focusing on just hard decisions to test the pure principles of moral judgment, if we talk about what kind of a story we're living in, what kind of persons we are, what kind of heritage we come from, and what kind of hope we live toward, we'll just find that ethics has many more dimensions than asking about shall I or shall I not make an exception to the rule against shedding blood. Another line of this same kind of more recent complaint about modes of moral reasoning is something that's older, but it's being said again. When you put it this way, it sounds as if your preoccupation is not to sin. That is, murder is a sin. I don't want to commit murder. Lying is a sin. Is this a lie? Robbery, adultery, there are a finite number of sins which can be labeled, and you want to be sure that you don't commit those things. Well, that is one way to do ethics. Certain things are wrong. Two wrongs don't make a right. But what if we were to ask instead, which actions praise God? Or which actions reflect the meaning of God coming into the world in Jesus? That we wouldn't be preoccupied for not having a black mark, but would be preoccupied for how we contribute to the world we're in as something that resonates with or something that echoes what came to us by way of gospel. And one more formal comment before I move to something very different that fills out the rest of the discussion in a quite different way. This debate assumed, and I set it up that way because I'm reporting on the last two centuries, that Jesus is on the side of principle saying, don't kill, for instance, and that the necessity of lethal political force in keeping the peace in a civil society, or revolution in an unjust society, or war between nations, is on the consequential side. What if it were the other way around? What if it were really the case that the will of God for humanity is consequences, namely the kingdom of God, that things be as they should be, shalom, and that that's a general consequence, but it is defined as God's purpose for all of us in such a way that it includes the well-being of the enemy, and therefore you can't kill the enemy in the name of his shalom. But it isn't because we have a rigid, narrow prohibition of bloodshed. It's because the enemy is also included in the purpose of the kingdom of God for the well-being of all God's creatures. Well, then that's consequence reasoning. And if, on the other hand, people said, never let down your nation or never fail the flag, that's principle reasoning. So it isn't really the case, this principle prudence polarity that people have always tried to impose on the war question as it really fits. Everybody reasons on both sides of that polarity. Everybody sometimes uses simple principle commitments where they seem to be adequate to illuminate a choice and determine that something is imperative or wrong. And everybody sometimes calculates consequences. And this whole split, which has practically, I think it's not unfair to say, it's dominated ethical thought for the past two centuries, is a mistake. Because we always reason on both sides. We always use both kinds of reasoning. And to think that you can get away from one and use only the other is a mistake. But now I turn to a completely different way of looking at this question that comes from our concrete life rather than from this categorical analysis, namely the contribution, and it's a cultural intellectual contribution, not just a tactical one, of Gandhi and King to this question. Gandhi and King were not, obviously, professional intellectuals. They were popular, movers of people. Gandhi used words mostly as an editor, mostly of a weekly paper or magazine, in which he kept writing small columns. He never wrote much at a time. And then, of course, he moved people by gathering crowds for major events. Martin Luther King was a preacher, preached every Sunday and sometimes every day of the week in Baptist churches and other places. He did write books, but the level of communication that we know him for was, again, popular. Yet, their being popular communicators did not mean that they didn't have a fundamentally important insight into the major values of Western culture, including its moral thought. Gandhi had an earned law degree. King had an earned doctorate in theology. So beneath what they did popularly so well, they were also basically operating from a deep moral insight. And this is stated numerous times in Gandhi's writings, sometimes in answering questions that come into his magazine. It's the ends means question. That's the wording in which it is put. Isn't it sometimes necessary, Gandhi says, people ask him, to use an evil means, namely some kind of lethal violence against the British, for a good end, when that's all you can do? And Gandhi always answers, repeatedly in different phrasings and different times and places over the 30 years that he was writing these things, you can't that way separate the means and the ends, because the means are the ends in process of becoming. The ends are the fruit of the means you choose. You can't get a good fruit from a sick tree, to use Jesus' language. So that the very pattern of analysis that wanted to pull them apart to say, well, use less than fully morally valid means because we have a very clearly imperative end, it's a mistaken view of the cosmos. It's a failure to see the way means and ends hang together. Now, on the first level, this is simple sobriety about the way the world is. That is, things do hang together. And when I tell myself I'm in a circumstance where for a good cause I ought to break the rules, where for the sake of some long-range end, it's appropriate that I use means that are manipulative, destructive, hateful, both King and Gandhi said, they were too sober about human nature to think that anybody has the right to give themselves that authority to make the exceptions. But it's deeper than that. Both of these men held to what I'd call a moral cosmology. That is, the world is such. It isn't only that I am such in my sinfulness and impatience and narrowness of view that I shouldn't trust myself to decide when I can sacrifice means to ends. But it's more than that. It's the world is such that in the average and in the long run, although it may look differently in the short run, only good behavior will produce good results. And evil means will produce evil ends. And Gandhi said that in a lot of different ways. Gandhi could say it in his frame of reference, because although he had a lot of Western input, he was still Hindu. He could say it in the philosophical setting of the Hindu worldview, in which no cause ever gets lost. The great chain of being finally includes everything. Every evil deed will keep on producing evil results eternally. And every good deed will keep on producing good results eternally. And if it doesn't work out before you die, you'll reincarnate and there'll be another chance. He talked several times about the fact that, as he saw it, Westerners are impatient because they believe you only have a couple weeks to do some things and you only have one life to do some things. We can afford to wait. Our Asian wisdom, Gandhi would say, is not short-sighted about how long it'll take for good means to produce good ends. We're not impatient. So there's an order to the cosmos. With time, it'll have to work itself out. So it was not rooted in social science or recent history, although he could argue on that level too. It was rooted in a religious vision of world history under the guidance of the moral wisdom of the Hindu understanding of the divine presence, which obviously is specifically his. He added Christian and Muslim elements, Buddhist elements to the surface of his movement, but there was basically that confidence that the reason ends and means have to cohere is that moral cosmology. But that coincided with what he learned at Bard from the West. I have here a quotation from his own autobiographical work in which he describes one particular input he got from the West. Tolstoy's book, The Kingdom of God is Within You, overwhelmed me. Before the independent thinking, profound morality, and the truthfulness of this book, all the books given me by Mr. Coates, that was a Quaker in South Africa who had given him some other books, seemed to pale into insignificance. I made too an intensive study of Tolstoy's other books, you know, he names two others. I began to realize more and more the infinite possibilities of universal love. That's his summary of what he got from Tolstoy. But Tolstoy didn't say it that way. He says it that way because in his Hindu grasp of things, you put love into the system and love has to come out. And Tolstoy's much simpler pounding on the principles of the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus just says, love your enemies and don't resist evil, and that's the reason for it. Gandhi transmuted it into this confidence that love is infinitely powerful. And if you don't see love working right away, well, then wait. It will. That's Gandhi's specimen of the moral cosmology. King is a little different, but he specifically cites this rootage in the argument of Gandhi as a part of where he comes from and a part of what made it possible for him in the mid-50s to start the process that put him in his place in history. One of the sources, obviously, of King's understanding of the moral universe is his Black Baptist faith, with its picking up the biblical heritage of Moses, freeing people, and God intervening miraculously to help the people be free. Also the slave experience and the survival through that of a believing community. But King also was a modern American secular liberal. He went to the most liberal Methodist seminary in Boston for his graduate study. He had been at one of the more liberal Baptist seminaries in Philadelphia before that for his seminary training. So he was also the heir to the modern Western American idea that things are getting better, and that free speech and separation of powers and the other values of our society cannot but make things get better and better. And he was also, through his education, a mainstream Christian. That is, he was not only the captive of the Black Baptist culture, but he knew his way around in the mid-American Protestant world of University Methodism. All of those came together. They were all a little different, but they all made sense of his saying, his normal phrase, which he also got from Gandhi, is unearned suffering is redemptive. That is, if you take upon yourself, not unwillingly, as the slave must do, but willingly, as a part of your Christian obedience, the cost of your renouncing violence, and you suffer for it, that is redemptive. Obviously, that's immediately drawing on the New Testament story itself, but the claim is that it echoes up and down history as well. The most frequent quotation, if you go back through all his speeches and watch the film record of his many public appearances, where very often he would speak impromptu, that is, without having prepared a new text for this place, and there he'd draw on the backlog of his wealth of things he knew by heart and things he'd used before. His most frequent response to the question, well, why is unearned suffering redemptive, was a poem from James Russell Lowell. Will the cause of evil prosper, yet his truth alone is strong, though her portion be the scaffold and upon the throne be wrong, yet that scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. It's a very white, liberal Protestant piece of poetry. But for King, it made sense. It put what his people were doing in a framework where the world, the cosmos, the universe, is on our side, even though it doesn't show. It isn't a fact out there that you can prove with the cameramen and the reporters, but we know that things are going for good. And he had his combination of the Black Baptist hope and the American political hope and a liberal Protestant hope that society will get better. Each of those has shortcomings, but added up, it permitted him to lead his people in accepting the kind of suffering that made that kind of sense. But this moral cosmology, it is this claim that the universe is of such a nature that what ultimately will have to win in the end is the right action, namely the loving, suffering, serving action, is not, with either Gandhi or King, preached from the top of a mountaintop or proclaimed from the top down academically or institutionally. What both of these men did, more than anybody else in the same setting, was to find, to create or to invent, and sometimes to copy, to modify tactics and techniques, that is, concrete ways of behaving in situations of unjust social structure or of stress that would work. That is, techniques which were effective, that puts us on the left column, but they were effective because of their moral commitment, that they weren't just opportunistically figuring out the best way to get from here to there in the shortest time, but they were, because of their principled commitment to truth-telling and openness and respect for the adversary and respect for just laws, they were able to be more effective. And a social psychologist can analyze some of the reasons why social strategy based on principle is stronger than one based on shrewd maneuvering for short-range goals. If you make a moral position behind, you're not just fighting for your own interests, but you're fighting for human rights or for the meaning of the Constitution, in the case of King's activity, obviously. Usually had the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights on his side. And if you say, we teach our people not to use violence, before we organize a march, we make everybody who goes in the march promise not to use violence, that moral commitment strengthens the appeal to public opinion, to the rest of society. Whereas if the insurgents had taken to mobbing, looting, as sometimes did happen when things got out of control, that decreased the credibility of the operation. So the principled commitment is effective. Principle and effectiveness are not in two different columns. It's effective because it's principled. Commitment to the dignity of the adversary raises the chance that since the adversary is assured, although he doesn't believe it right away, but he at least has the promise that we're not out for his death and destruction, but only to liberate him from being an oppressor, you might find together some way to negotiate a solution that will be better than carrying the battle to the ultimate destruction. And that does really happen, that you find creative conclusions that weren't there before, because you're committed to keeping the adversary in the dialogue. There are also some superficial benefits. If in a movement that's trying to engineer social change, you always keep open the possibility that at a certain point you might start killing people, or at a certain point you will deceive people, then you have to have a very careful command and control information communication system, and make sure that nobody gets any of your secrets, and have some central place that decides when you're going to move from nonviolence to violence. If ahead of time you have committed yourself to have no secrets and no violence, then you don't have to have much central organization. You can trust your troops out there. And movements can be more validly decentralized and can be more effective because you don't always have to phone back to the headquarters to know whether this week we're still going to be nonviolent or not. Or whether next week is the time that we lose patience with the authorities and go over the brink into another kind of war. So there are practical values of a principled commitment. You can run a movement better with this kind of sense of what you want to ever do than if you do that kind of prudent calculation all the time about what we might win the next time if we'd make a few exceptions. So it wasn't wrong. It was a little misleading, but it wasn't false when in the 30s some of the first interpreters of Gandhi in the West would use a book title like War Without Violence, meaning you can carry on effective conflict for the sake of some valid interest, if you have a morally valid interest, better, more effectively, if your renunciation of violence is built into the strategy. Now, that certainly isn't true for all kinds of conflict. You can't respond nonviolently to a nuclear weapon or to a tank invading a border at the time. But the kinds of places where this can work are more than you would have thought of. And the kinds of places where violent response to violence will work are fewer and fewer, of course, as the weapons escalate. Now, the minimum level of this argument that Gandhi and King have shown us that you can protect at least some valid goals by nonviolent conflict rather than violent conflict is that it makes us reassess the discussion we had in the last two sessions about the just war tradition. The just war tradition says you don't start killing people until it's the very last thing you can do. It must be last resort. Well, if you haven't tried these other things, you aren't in a situation of last resort yet. That's a superficial way to make the argument. But deeper than this, there is coming to be a vision of another level of what society would look like if we started with the assumption that most social clashes could be handled through other modes of conflict, not without conflict, and not by just accepting the setting we have, but by modes of conflict and change that aren't trigger happy, that don't think that the first real way to be importantly powerful is to reach for lethal weapons. And I'll back up now a little to the people that have been starting to talk this way since Hiroshima. Stephen King Hall was an officer in the British Royal Navy, a commander, in 1945. And he was intellectually so organized and respected that he was a teacher of military science in both the Army and the Navy War Colleges of the United Kingdom, and the editor of a newsletter. The King Hall newsletter was, for upper-level officers, what the Kiplinger newsletter is for people wanting to invest money in America. It was the ordinary place to go for thinking about the technical wisdom in your field. The week after Hiroshima, since it was 1 week after Hiroshima, it was a couple days after Nagasaki, so both bombs had been dropped. He wrote in his newsletter, "Those two bombs may have been, I think will prove to have been, the last explosions of consequence in the history of large-scale war. Total war is at an end. Total war has made political and economic nationalism a meaningless thing. Total war has abolished itself." Now, this man is not a pacifist. He's a hard-nosed military scientist who knows what it means to win a war, and therefore he also knows what it means not to win a war. And he knows that if you ever use these weapons, you lose on both sides of any war. A lot of military people say that today, but he saw it 30 years ago. 40 years ago, August 45. And then what are you going to do? Well, he was a staunch anti-communist, Anglo-Saxon Democrat. He said, we're going to have to organize to defend our Anglo-Saxon values without weapons, without lethal weapons, because we already can see that with these weapons, we can't defend them. We can use the weapons, but we can't defend our values, because the values have outgrown the possibility that they can ever be rationally used to defend our values. Maybe he overstated the case the way it truly stood in 1945, but he stated a case that people now increasingly see to apply once we have thousands of these weapons aimed at each other. You can't possibly use this kind of weapon in a war in which you will save your democratic values. Well, what are we going to do? Well, he wasn't very profound at that point. He talked about preparing, just as we train people to be officers in the kind of war we fought in the past, we ought to train people to be leaders in the kind of conflict we'd have in the future. If we were to respond to a Russian occupation of Great Britain without losing our national character and our national values, we have to find ways of fighting back psychologically, of fighting back nonviolently. Although he didn't think he was a Gandhian, he thought he was a hard-nosed British military scientist. We could defend democracy better, obviously because it's a better system, and we could defend it in ways that are intrinsically compatible with it. We could do a better job defending democracy against some kind of hostile invasion than any invader could do trying to take us over in the name of some other political system that would be best, less humane and less democratic and less morally acceptable. But it's important to me for the history of the thing that this is not a pacifist at all. He hadn't learned anything from Gandhi. King wasn't on the scene yet. And he says, if we want to defend Britain's values, we can't afford ever to have another war. We're going to have some other kind of conflict. Now, what that other kind of conflict could be is getting more attention, although it's still a minority thing, but it's one of the things that are afoot in the universe, to use the slogan of the summer. There is an increasing bulk of social science work done by people in political science and sociology and psychology departments of universities, and other kinds of social service agencies, on alternative ways to handle conflict so that what we used to assume you can only do with a war can be done by other means in war. The strongest statements of this kind of thing are those made by, or the strongest total impact, a man named Gene Sharp, whose Harvard dissertation about 15 years ago was on the politics of nonviolent action, based on a kind of catalog of, I think it was 99 different types of nonviolent action, and that was based on a catalog of hundreds of cases, episodes of successful nonviolent action for this or that purpose. Not proving that you can win everything nonviolently. You can't win everything violently. Actually, in every war, one party loses, and in most wars, both parties lose. So you don't have to prove a success rate of 95% if you just indicate that it's credible that you don't have to give up on profound values. You can be effective in defending your values without institutional lethal violence of the kind that we will escalate to in the future if we use the weapons we have. He'd been saying this kind of thing before, but he said it especially again after the change of government in Manila 2 years ago in February. Comparing the fact that what happened in Manila was almost without preparation. That is, there was no long-range training of all kinds of people to intervene between two armies the way it had happened. The way in which the Roman Catholic bishops called out people, and those people just stood in the streets for 4 days and kept the two armies from fighting each other until Marcos gave up, was practically unplanned. And I'll quote Sharp. In the past, most nonviolent struggles have been improvised without large-scale preparation or training. Thus, they may be simply prototypes of what could be developed by deliberate efforts. It seems certain that a combination of scholarship and preparation could make future nonviolent struggles much more effective. It is possible that this technique could become a full substitute for violence in liberation struggles and even for national defense. Now, that's an intellectual projection, but it's based on a track record of anecdotes where people were surprised how much could be done without violence in certain circumstances. And the very last kind of stirring in the universe that I'd report is a broader scope of political science thinking by journalists and public philosophers and political scientists, not only in university settings, but elsewhere in the political journalistic realm. Once you've decided that guns are what it takes to make things happen politically, and you concentrate on the histories of guns and the use of guns, then you get to the kind of world we have. But there's much political unity that isn't based on guns. We use the postal system internationally, and you never have to fight about whether people are going to take each other's mailbags off the airplane, and you can write to enemy countries. The waterways, fishing, various chunks of reality are already managed on an international level. It's complicated, but progress is being made. France and Germany can't fight each other anymore because they're part of a larger unity. The United States and Canada can never have a war because we're not set up to have a war. More and more, if you just stop and think, the human community survives because most human community is not structured at the point of a gun. And the places where there are still guns at the borders are the places where the normal fabric of human community hasn't been permitted to grow yet. But the more you look at it, the more you see that we have international commerce, we have international concern about pollution, because there is a reality to human community that is not structured around the sword, but around a changing consciousness of our shared humanity. One of the people writing the books that are well-read in that area is a colleague of mine at Notre Dame just now, named Robert Johansson, just came there because we have a thing called the Peace Institute, thanks to McDonald's hamburgers, because it was the heiress, Jean Kroc, who gave us the money to have a peace studies program. We can learn to think differently about international conflict. So that, again, the the assumption that loving your neighbors is a narrow-minded moral rigidity, and gearing up to destroy them is realistic concern for effectiveness and consequences, is just an outmoded way of analyzing most of our problems. It won't go away. It isn't utterly impertinent. But the part of the world that it describes is getting smaller and smaller. Excuse me, that was 10 minutes longer than I wanted to be. Any kind of feedback or further comment?
One of the things that is disturbing to me is the massive buildup on the United States part in the concept of low-intensity warfare, and seeing problems in the third world as needing to be resolved primarily through various forms of conflict, including military. I guess I'm just making a comment, because what you've said is very persuasive to me. And I think of the number of situations that they even tacitly admit are probably caused by inadequate social situations and a lack of reform. They know the cause. It seems to me what you're saying is that the solution clearly is to value these people and try to operate fairly, but it seems as though the direction of policy within the last 8 years has been a very precipitous move, as I understand it, towards seeing things in a low-intensity military conflict point of view. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I think it is. That is one part of the picture that's getting worse, because in Pentagon theory circles, there's more attention to that, and it's being done with a good conscience and in a studied way more than before. I don't think it's not brand new. The wisdom in this matter comes back from the British pacification of Malaysia 25 years ago. That is, there are ways when irregular war is going on, instead of trying to bomb the place back to the Stone Age the way we did with Vietnam, people who consider themselves to be the forces of order can behave decently and gradually lower the pressure of the insurgency by improving the government. You can do that without democracy if you're the British Empire saving Malaysia. So that's a lot better than high-intensity warfare. It isn't enough yet. But the fact that people recognize that they'll have to keep the intensity low is itself a concession to something changing in the world consciousness, partly in the sense of the moral sensibilities of people, and partly because of the awareness that anything that you escalate is going to blow up in your face and you'll serve more than they will. So it's both pragmatic and insightful. I think American citizens will be more and more careful to watch and monitor this notion that as long as you keep the intensity down, it's all right to have those wars. But the fact that wars are being reduced to that is itself a step forward, as over against readiness to destroy half the globe in a massive bipolar conflagration.
As far as the way that we observe Memorial Day, Armistice Day, Veterans Day, the Vietnam Wall in Washington, how do you see this sort of affecting, or is there better ways of acknowledging things, or any insights do you have to share on that?
Well, not many insights or sharp ideas. I think it's a very proper observation that much of what sustains a saber-rattling national self-awareness is not bloodthirsty people in the Pentagon, but it's the culture across the land and the way we celebrate national identity as having been reinforced and saved by all our wars. So it would be very appropriate to figure out, and we have 3 days to do it, an alternative way to celebrate the 4th of July. and find ways. I think the Vietnam Wall itself is a big step forward, because it didn't glorify the troops themselves doing a heroic thing. It's just a place for mourning, really, with a concession off to the side of one small statue that represents men in combat. But certainly a large part of the notion that patriotic values are those which relate to destroying other people, and real men are the people who are ready to do that when they have to. The cultural rootage of our violence is very deep.
As far as so many times in our society, I still hear and talk to vets from World War II still waking up in cold sweats and nightmares and things that go on, and yet you get these people together and the intensity of the memory and the experience, and that there isn't, positive things to give people that strong of unity of feeling and experiences and memories in our society. See these people get together, it's an incredible comradeship that we, I think it's too bad that we have used those kinds of things to provide the kind of glue that brings people together.
We should celebrate the civil rights movement or some valid thing that people did at great cost to substitute for that. But I think it's a very sobering and frightening observation that the basic national values with regard to whether people of another place or another color have human dignity are not cultivated in church. They're cultivated in reminiscing sessions about the times when we were at a front somewhere destroying the people on the other side. And that's what we celebrate.
When I was riding the boat here, I was reading the Seattle paper, and there was an article, a little small news item about a soldier that had been discharged because he was homosexual a few years ago, and he just recently died of AIDS. And on his tombstone are the words something to this effect: "I got a purple medal, a purple heart, for killing two men. And I got thrown out, discharged from the army, because I loved one man."
Since we're going to have to line up for a picnic, if anybody wants to be first in the line, you better run. Otherwise, there's no point in running, and you could keep on chatting a little. We're probably off the tape.
Very much.
It's more academic than I've ever tried to be. I'm not sure.
Well.